Well, welcome to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Well, our Chapel Hill neighbor, Major General Arthur W. Clark, U.S. Air Force retired, is the author of a recent book called Eyes of the Tiger, China, 1944 through 1945. And it is an expansion on the Mr. Clark's, or General Clark's, diary of his experience as a young intelligence officer at the end of World War II, from America through the European sector and into India, and then across the hump into China, where he served under as an intelligence officer, as looking primarily trying to figure out what happened based on photographs taken. But it put him in and under the command of a very famous general. Welcome. May I just call you Arthur instead of General Clark?
Yeah, please do.
One of the exciting things is that you were connected to one of America's great heroes, General Chenault.
Yes, and the title of the book, Eyes of the Tiger, the eyes of the tiger were the reconnaissance aircraft that were taking the photographs that served as eyes for the flying tigers. Chenault's original forces of the American Volunteer Group prior to our entry into the war was in 1940 and 41. And they were mercenaries. And when the war came along, some of them, five of them, went directly with Chenault back in service. Chenault had retired in 37 from the military, had been an advisor to the Chinese, and really started the American Volunteer Group. And then during the war, some of those men distinguished themselves again. For example, one of the men, Ed Rector from North Carolina, had credit for 10 plus Japanese aircraft as a flying tiger. Tex Hill was another one with a 10 plus record. And they followed Chenault into the 14th Air Force. And the name Flying Tiger persisted. We were known as the Flying Tigers in the time we were there during the war. Actually, our shoulder patch, the Flying Tiger design, had been done by Walt Disney.
No, is that right? On,
which was kind of interesting.
And did he do it for Chenault when he was sort of operating privately, or did that come
after? I'm not sure whether he did it originally or whether it was related to a comic strip development or what, but how it came about. Ed Rector, I mentioned, has North Carolina ties. Not only was he from the western part of the state, he had a sister who lived in Durham, and his niece was married to Fairby Taylor, to Chantley Fairby Taylor.
Wow.
And I got to know him when he was head of the 23rd Fighter Group over there in China. But we were a photo reconnaissance outfit. Our aircraft were P-38s. And our particular group, our small group that I was in, operated right in the foothills of the Himalayan mountains. And the way we got there is worth mentioning.
Well, this is there are so many places in your book that I'd like to go to, but one of the first part of the book and one of the most interesting parts, that's nothing to do really with China except in getting there. And you want to tell us?
Well, we got there.
Briefly?
It took us 5 months.
Took you 5 months to get from the United States.
We started from Will Rogers Field, which is now where the FAA headquarters is in Oklahoma City, by troop train to Hampton Roads to the Norfolk area. We were in an 88-ship convoy that sailed 19 days.
Did you know where you're going?
No. No, we didn't know where we were going, and a sister squadron got hit by an aerial torpedo, and the squadron disappeared. Really, they lost 300 and some people, and the rest were casualties, so they kind of reshuffled the geography, I think, a little bit. But we got to Oran in the convoy, and then we went.
All right, now you
got to
tell some of us where Oran is.
Oran in Algeria.
Okay.
And then.
So you come into the Mediterranean?
Yes. Okay. We came in by Gibraltar, and the convoy broke up into pieces that went different ways.
Arthur Clark, I apologize for keeping, but this would be in 1944. And it's so.
Early 44.
They're still fighting in Italy pretty.
Oh, yeah.
But the North African sector was
pretty quieted down. But we went on one British ship from Oran to Port Said in Egypt. Then we went on another British ship, a P&O liner, Pacific and Orient liner. We went on the Strathmore from there down to what was then Bombay in India. And that ship went on with British troops and nurses and on down to Ceylon, Sri Lanka. So we got to India, and we had left in early April. We were now into June, and we were there on D-Day. We were in,
you were in
India on D-Day.
By this time, did you know where you were going? They told you what you were going to do?
Yeah, we found out where we were going, and we told the troops where we were going after we went through the Suez Canal on the Strathmore. We were in the Red Sea, and we told them we were going to China, and they were flabbergasted, and they said, China? I thought the war was in Europe and the Pacific. What's going on in China? We said, you'll find out when you get there. So we got into India and took a miserable troop train that took 5 days across India in the hot monsoon weather with no toilet facilities. We stopped twice a day. We could eat our rations on the side of the tracks, and the engineer for a cigarette would turn on the steam to clean our mess kits. And one place we actually got a shower under a standpipe when they were refueling the engines. With coal, we got under one of the things that they used to fill the water tanks and took our clothes off and marched through and soaped up and marched back through. And that was a big incident because some missionaries apparently complained to their congressman that American soldiers were running around naked, and it caused something of an incident that our commanding officer had to deal with. Anyway, we got into Calcutta, and we were there for some period of time, for the rest of June, all of July, and
can you
August.
You landed on the east, on the west coast of India.
Correct.
And then you're making your way towards what is now, I guess, Bangladesh, the part of India over on the
That's right, over into Bengal province. And Bengal province in 1943 and early 44 was in distressing shape. They had lost, the reports run from 1.5 to 4 million people in the famine, in the 43 famine. And most people use the figure 3 million died. We saw people dying literally in the streets, people that never had a shoe on their foot or a roof over their head. And lots of people were literally still starving. So we were there while we reconfigured our airplanes. We did no longer need a mess section or
Let
heavy
me just,
equipment.
I apologize, Arthur, for interrupting, but airplanes, how did you have the airplanes on the train? How did the airplanes get there?
Our airplanes got there on shipboard, and the big airplanes, the four-engine airplanes, were able to fly across the water. The bombers that were the four-engine bombers that we had, that we didn't have, the 14th Air Force had, they would come down through Brazil and across through the north, across to North Africa, and come that way and fly themselves, obviously.
And then land
the
in China.
Our planes landed in by ship, and then flew across India, and we were reconfiguring the unit. The Chinese were going to feed us under reverse lend-lease that T.V. Sung, Madame Chang's brother, had worked out with in Washington. So we were fed the way the Chinese troops were fed, same food, same everything. So we didn't need a mess section. We didn't need heavy equipment. Everything that we had and everybody else had to be flown to China. The Japanese had now occupied Burma, so they were in control of Burma.
They cut off that what we
the
thought
Burma
of the
road,
Burma Road.
The Burma Road was severed. There was no way. Obviously, you couldn't come in across the Pacific into China because of the war in the Pacific. So the only way to get there, starting in 1942, was to fly across the Himalaya Mountains into China. And the aircraft used were primarily C-47s and C-46s, which were twin engines, piston-driven, non-pressurized aircraft. The C-47 was like a civilian DC-3, which was, I think, a 21-passenger.
So you're flying 20,000
You're flying,
or pretty high up anyway.
Yeah, if you don't go high up, you're too far south, and you're within reach of the Japanese fighter aircraft, which got some, did some damage out of mission on some other places. So the pressure was on you to fly farther to north over the higher mountains. So you were pushing your planes as high as they could go with a heavy load carrying all of the equipment, all of the people, and everything that came into China.
Was that the only way that the United States forces were resupplying General Chenault's forces in China, was by air over the hump?
And this went on from 1942, when this was the first strategic airlift got started, and went all the way to 45. The Burma Road was rejoined in January of 45. The Chinese had resisted the Japanese moving eastward into China. The Japanese already occupied East China. They had come from Japan across the water and moved, and they were moving westward towards Kunming in Yunnan province, which was our hub. That's where we landed most of our airplanes coming over the hump landed.
Just again, for geography's sake, this is Kunming is sort of in the southern, the very southern part of Japan, on the west side of Japan. I mean, I'm sorry, of China. The southern part of China. And
we,
maybe the southwest
we were
chance.
On the western part of China. We were very close to Tibet. Yunnan province, where we were, in Sichuan province, are right near Tibet. The planes that came over from India came from the Assam Valley, Chabwa, which was a spur of India that runs up into the Himalaya there. The monsoon, the average rainfall in that area had been 499 inches a year all during the monsoon, so the weather was terrible. So the aircraft had to fly in terrible weather over the Himalaya, and the loss rate over the period of from 42 to 45 was more than 700 aircraft that went down. And one of the pieces of black humor was, if you were flying one of these airplanes that were twin engine now, not pressurized, you're sucking on oxygen and you're just trying to squeeze over the mountains. And we used to talk, the clouds were known as cumulogranitus because a lot of the clouds had granite in them. And one of the sayings was that, well, if you're flying that twin-engine plane and you lose one engine, you still got enough power to get to the crash site. So it was a pretty dangerous business.
Well,
that was the only way in and out. And when we got over there, now our squadron was split into four units. And
before we do this, let's take a quick break.
Yeah.
And those, if you joined us late, I'm visiting with Arthur Clark. He's written a new book called Eyes of the Tiger, talking about his experience in World War II primarily in China. And we'll be back to continue that conversation after this short break. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I'm visiting with Arthur Clark. He's a friend of ours, a neighbor of ours in Chapel Hill, now living in the Cedars. He's written a book called Eyes of the Tiger. It's about his World War II experiences, unusual and for me very fascinating. Arthur, you've gotten us into the war scene where you stopped traveling and you started to work.
Well, we were one of two photo reconnaissance squadrons in China, both equipped with P-38 aircraft. There was also a fighter outfit in China with P-38 aircraft, the 449th fighter. So there were three squadrons in China with P-38s. Two of them were photo reconnaissance. Our squadron, like the other squadron, like the 21st, was split into smaller units we called flights. And the flight that I was in, the G flight of the 35th Photo Reconnaissance Squadron, we had about a total of 50 men. We had a photo officer, an engineering officer, a communication officer. I was the intelligence officer. And we had four pilots. We started off with four planes. After about a week, we had three left. One of them made a hard landing. And so we were sent west, where the Japanese were trying to come from Burma eastward across the Salween River and into Kunming. So the Japanese strategy was to have the big bulk of their forces moving westward from the east towards Kunming and moving the ones from Burma eastward across the Salween. They did not make it. And in January of 1945, the Burma Road was rejoined right at the Salween River in Wanling. Now, the Burma Road did not carry very much during the remainder of the war. In the first convoy got to Kunming in February, and the amount of tonnage that was carried by the trucks was very small.
So the airplanes were doing continually most of the job to get over the hump.
I think they carried about 65,000.
Well, let me ask you, talk to me a little bit more about what was going on under General Chennault's overall command and how you were helping, if at all, to resist the Japanese movement, the sort of pincer movements that were coming towards you. Did you have any troops to resist, or was this all a Chinese function?
The Americans' function was the air function. We had heavy bombers, B-24s. There was a separate operation of a B-29 operation, Operation Matterhorn. But B-29s came in out of India and were stationed there and attacked Japan from the west. That was a separate operation.
Were they operating out of Kunming, or were they?
No, they were not operating. They were operating out of an area up at Chengdu, farther north. And I was up there watching them build one of the runways. The place that I watched, they were building, they were using 60,000 Chinese people to build that runway. It was entirely built by hand, entirely. There was no mechanical equipment. The final part of the runway, after the bases had been done, you had broken up the rocks and hammered them in and so on. The final thing was to roll the top surface, and that was done by harnessing 100 to 200 Chinese people into harness to pull huge stone rollers. It was absolutely incredible.
So they were the horsepower.
They were the horsepower. People. It was all done manually. They lived right there by the side of the runway. That was the way it operated.
You mentioned in your book that during this time, the Chinese were so worried about the Japanese takeover of their country that the two different factions of Chinese, that is the Chiang Kai-shek nationalist faction, which was theoretically in charge, had been fighting against Mao Zedong's faction, and that they, at least in part, stopped their battle against each other to resist the Japanese. Did that complicate things for you?
It did. The Americans had advisory forces. We had some army units that were advisors that were sort of the model for what came apart in Vietnam. Didn't work out very well, but it worked out there. We were involved on the little airfield that we operated off of, which had been built by the Flying Tigers originally. We had three P-38s, and we had our group of 50th were in tents. Across the road from us were tents of a B-25 outfit, the 22nd Bomb Squadron. They had three B-25s, and we had three P-38s on this one field with a 4,800-foot dirt runway. And our gasoline, our aviation fuel was flown in from India in 55-gallon drums, and we pumped it manually. Our men pumped it up into the drop tanks on the P-38s. And we got in the winter, we were up there in the mountains at 6,500 feet or so, and we got charcoal from the warlord when he gave it to us. Now, the warlord in Yunnan, his name was Lung, L-U-N-G.
Now, did he work? How did he fit into the Chinese government at that time?
At this point in time that we're talking about in 44 and 45, Mao was up north, was in the northern part. We got cooperation from him in the sense of if we had people bailing out up there, he was cooperative getting them back to us. Just as Ho Chi Minh, for instance, in Indochina, if he could get to one of our people, we would get him back. He had to get to him before the Japanese did, so people tried to bail out up in the higher country. But the antagonism between Mao and Chiang was alive and well. And they were both squirreling away weapons that they got from us to use against each other when the time got right. And Warlord Lung was also looking after himself and planning to try to break loose from Chiang Kai-shek and run the things in Yunnan himself. He and Chiang had fought it out, and he lost in October of 45, after the war was over, and Warlord Lung wound up going up north and becoming an official with Mao, where he had a state funeral, and his oldest son, I know, was running a restaurant the last time I saw him on Connecticut Avenue
across
the
zoo
in Washington. So these people were not giving the complete, wholehearted effort, either the Chiang people or Mao people, to fighting the Japanese that the Americans would have liked. Chennault had pioneered, going back to him, during his Flying Tiger days, the reason he was so successful against the Japanese, he would not try to let his people get into dogfights with Zeros. They couldn't turn as tightly as a Zero. What he did, he had his planes, his P-40s, Warhawks, get up above, for they were up above, and they would see a bunch of Japanese fighters, and they would make a diving pass through them. They just make one diving pass through.
And then run away, and then do the damage. And
do all the damage they could and get out of the way and not get
in. So the Japanese planes were better.
The Japanese planes were very good at dogfighting. And I can remember one time in the book I mentioned leaflets that were dropped on us in propaganda. And one of the things that we picked up was a note from the Japanese challenging the Americans to come up and fight.
Oh, come on.
Well, when the Americans did, the Americans won.
You know, so they did win in a dogfight. Are they using the tactics that you described?
This was later on.
Uh-huh.
This was, for example, the P-38 fighters in the 449th were very successful against the Japanese aircraft. P-38 at one point was probably the fastest plane in the world until the German jet came along, the ME-262. So we were really just sort of camped out, this small group of us. We were fed by the Chinese. The Chinese did various things to help
us. Can I interrupt you one more time now? When you're talking about the Chinese, you mentioned that there was a division of authority, the complicated division of authority. And in Kunming, a warlord was involved, and then Chiang Kai-shek was involved. Which one of those was feeding you?
Well, we were being fed really by Chiang Kai-shek, by the nationalists, mm-hmm. the Kuomintang. The nationalist government. Lung happened to be the warlord in that area, but he was a very powerful guy, and there were also bandits. If we drove on the piece of the Burma road that we had, there were bandits along there. You'd see shot up trucks and so on that were not ours. We didn't go unarmed, so we could take care of ourselves. But the politics of it was such that didn't really affect us. We took our orders from General Chennault in the 69th Composite Wing. We were under that wing. There was another wing called the Chinese American Composite Wing, CACW, in which you might have an American pilot and a Chinese co-pilot. The Chinese had been trained in Arizona or wherever, come over, and so we had mixed crews in that particular wing. And our relationship with the Chinese was fine. We had Chinese guards and Chinese looking after us, but we also had a problem with fifth columnists. We'd have, if a Japanese were trying to launch an attack on one of our bases, on our base, you might find that there were people lined up with the runway with Roman candles, if you will, shooting off flares that would guide the Japanese into where
these were Chinese
were.
Who were traitors or who'd been bribed?
These were people who were in the pay. Anything the Japanese would pay for any American document. It might be something sensitive or classified, but if you had left a field manual around how to march, it might disappear, and the Japanese, who obviously couldn't read it, would pay something for it, hoping to get something worthwhile. So stuff tended to disappear. It could be under your tent flap at night. Somebody could reach in under your cot.
Well, in a part of your book, you accuse some of your Chinese guards of stealing things from you.
Yes. That, unfortunately, that's true. I could remember walking through the Chinese village at night and seeing the thermos bottle of a B-25 sitting on the floor in there. I couldn't go in and take that. We had, for us to do that, we're required to get permission through 14th Air Force from the Chinese for us to go in and recover our stuff. And on one particular night, we had two different guard outfits, and we had a 55-gallon drum of fuel sitting out near P-38, and both of them were trying to steal the drum of fuel, and they got into
a fight over the...
They got into shooting at each other. I remember I could hear one of our guys had fallen into a ditch, and he was shaking his mess kit to rattle his mess kit and say, Megwa Joe, I'm an American. Don't shoot me. I don't think they killed each other. But they scared each other, and they scared us, too.
Wow.
And they never got the gasoline. But we had this kind of a problem. So the success that we had in working with the Chinese was pretty good on most things. But we had a problem with a lack of discipline in terms of things that were disturbing to us and were problems for managing our logistics, if you will.
If you joined us late, I'm visiting with Arthur Clark, our Chapel Hill neighbor, retired Air Force general and also a participant in World War II as an intelligence officer in the Army Air Corps as a lieutenant. And he's sharing with us some of the incredible experiences that he talks about in his book. And we'll talk some more after this short break. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. We're visiting with Arthur Clark. He's the author of Eyes of the Tiger, China, 1944-1945, the book, and our conversation is about his experiences during the war. And Arthur, the complexities of your mission in China continue to overwhelm me. When we study the war against Japan, it's always sort of the island-hopping effort to get to Japan. What were you all doing in China to support the effort to conquer Japan? Was it just a mission to sort of hold down a few Japanese troops in China to keep them busy, or were you really trying to win back China away from Japan, or were you just using it as a base maybe to have a few attacks on the Japanese islands?
Well, one of the things that impressed me and impressed all of us was the contrast between our experience in China and our experience in India. Our experience in India was so depressing. You hardly saw anybody who was healthy. They had all kinds of diseases our medical officer had never seen before. You know, you'd see elephantiasis and all these things, and all these emaciated people, and it was very depressing. We got over to China, and the Chinese people, in spite of the hardships, in spite of all they were going through, and all of the privations, were always seemed to be cheerful and upbeat, and were very pleasant to be around, as far as I was concerned. Now, what we were doing there, we were, as you suggest, holding down a large number of Japanese troops. And this became much more significant as the war came to near an end in 45. The plan was we moved our unit, our little unit that had been out there improvising and making do for itself and getting some generators and drilled a well for water so we could get water that hadn't been just dipped in off the field for fixing our meals. We had that experience, but now, after with the Salween campaign was over and we had been successful in that stopping the Japanese there, we moved briefly back to the Kunming area. We were sort of in a holding pattern. Then we moved our unit, moved down to near the Indochina border, near the sea down there, near the Luzhou Peninsula, Hainan Island, that part of China. And we wondered what we were going to do down there. The Japanese were in Indochina, and the Vichy French were in Indochina, though the Vichy French kind of helped us a little when they could. They were supposed to be Axis powers, but we had a good relation with some of the French, a little going back and forth. That part of the intelligence came we were in. But anyway, the word that we got was that we were going to have an invasion of Japan in November of 1945. And simultaneously with that, there would be an invasion of South China by the Americans who were retraining, I think, in Panama. And they were going to come in, so we would have an American force on the ground behind the Japanese in China. And the Japanese, the large number of Japanese in China, would be pinned down and not be able to get back to the homeland.
To trap them so they couldn't get back to
They would be trapped.
To fight and you on the Japanese
The Americans, island. I think, were plan was to come into Kyushu to the South Island and establish air bases there and operate from there. But that
You were not going to let them retreat. I mean, you were not going to let them retreat
We were not going to let them go back to Japan. That is correct. That the Japanese forces in China would be stuck there and would not be available to defend the homeland. And that was the word that we got. And, of course, that all came to an end on the 6th of August.
Well, before we move on towards the end of the war, and this conversation is so much fun, we're going to have to end it before we finish, but what did you do? You were an Air Force intelligence officer,
yeah.
And you were examining photographs
we did two things. We were acquiring targets. We were photographing targets, and we were doing bomb damage assessment. So here we had these three B-25, three twin-engine bombers, or medium bombers, and our reconnaissance planes. We'd go out and photograph a river, say, with all the bridges along that river. And then the bombers would go out, and they would bomb those bridges. And very often they were successful, and very often they weren't. Because a lot of the steel bridges, the bombs would go down and blow up in the water, and they'd see all the smoke and stuff and think that the bomb had been successful. We'd go over the next day and photograph it and do bomb damage assessment.
Were you just back there examining the photographs? Did you have to fly over in an airplane and make the photographs? What part did you? Or did you just supervise all of that?
I was the intelligence officer. I would identify a target. I would brief the crew. Here's what you're going to do. Where are you going to fly? What altitude? What kind of pictures you're taking? So on. And then when the guy came back in, I would debrief him and get information in addition to what he might have seen that would be useful to us. Sometimes I remember one target that we never could figure out exactly what it was doing until we got in there on the ground after the Japanese retreated. I did some flying with the bombers because, to tell you the truth, it was very hard for me to send people out. Lost the first man was in the first week of November, lost a fellow who disappeared, and I figured it was a weather problem, and it turned out about 5 years ago that it was a weather problem when the remains were found. And
you've gotten me into this now. This is a very poignant part of your story. Then many years later, up in the mountains that you were?
Well, right? I had felt like I had to go on some missions myself if I was sending people out. So I got to ride along with the bombers and do some bomb damage photographs for them myself. No, the thing you're talking about, one of the planes that crashed on the hump was in November of 1942. It was one of the very early losses. It was the number 60. Belonged to the Chinese National Aviation Corporation. It was flying a load of aluminum ingots back to India. And the Chinese National Air Corporation was, I think, 50% owned by Pan Am, who, like British Airways, were trying to get a little foothold because they saw the future of international aviation coming. Well, that plane that I spotted in January of 1945, I spotted the wreckage, And I was able to determine that it couldn't have been an American airplane, that because we had not lost a plane right in that area at that time. Many, many years later, I got in touch with a man who was an adventurous explorer who was looking for the remains of airplanes missing in action people in the CBI, in the China-Burma-India Theater. And he had found some 22. This particular airplane, he knew about. It had left its base in China. It got into icing conditions. It was losing altitude, and it was losing altitude so fast that it was going to pile into the mountains. So it turned south to try to get onto lower mountains in spite of the Japanese dangers. And he had drawn a line on his map as he collected these data, and it turned out that the line that he had drawn on the map went right over where I had seen this crash. I had tried to get to the crash site myself, foolishly, stupidly, in January. I took three people with me who were not experienced. I had a little bit of experience around the mountains. And we got caught in a blizzard, and that was a mess. Well, it turned out that in 1988, the Durham paper had an article about five American climbers that got killed in summer trying to do what we were trying to do in winter. But this man, Clayton Cools, said he was going to try to get to that airplane. And on his third attempt in October of 2011, he reached the airplane, got the tail numbers off of it, and now the pilot, who had been an AVG, a Flying Tiger in the old American Volunteer Group, and the co-pilot, who was American, their families now know what happened, when it happened, and so on. Well, the radio operator was Chinese.
That's a great story. We got to take a quick break, and then we'll come back and finish this story and wind up our conversation with Arthur Clark about his new book, Eyes of the Tiger. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I've been visiting with Arthur Clark about his book, Eyes of the Tiger, about his experiences at the end of World War II in China. And Arthur, I've done such a bad job of time management. We just got a minute or two left, and yep. I've gotten so excited about the book. Can you? How do you get copies?
Well, the easiest place, I guess, is Amazon. You can get them if you're in France or in China.
How about local Flyleaf and Bull's Head? Have you got them to stock it yet?
I have not talked to. I've been very busy with other things, my health problem in the family. But the book I really wrote for family and friends, and it was a family project. The editor of the book, it was one of my sons, Claiborne Clark, who has a lot of background in editing and producing. He was a TV newsman overseas for a number of years in Guam. He did documentaries. He anchored the evening news in Hong Kong. He was a stringer for NBC and had an experienced editor. The youngest son, who was with IBM, is a very good photo technician.
Beautiful photos in this book.
Brought the pictures back to life, took off the scratches and the dust and enhanced the resolution and so on. The oldest son, who's done a couple of books himself, who's a retired medical professor, made some useful suggestions. So it was a family project, and I kept saying, well, we're not really going to go through with it, but my wife insisted that she wanted that book. And a Chinese friend, a journalist and publisher, looked at the pictures, the old pictures I had in the album. He said, those pictures have got to be in a book because the history of China from 1911, from the revolution to 1949, was pretty well wiped out by Mao. They didn't even know Americans had been there. And he said, those pictures need to be in a book. So all of these things came together. And I haven't really done anything about market, but
well, I think you got. We're going to start a push for it because it's a very important book about the experience in World War II in an arena that we're not familiar with, and the pictures are fantastic. The idea that you show in the pictures what life was like in India and in the Kunming province of China, and I just wish we had a lot more time to talk about it today.
Well, I've enjoyed being with you. It's fun. It was fun doing the book, and it's fun being here with you, and I appreciate all you good things you do
in
our community.
Thanks to Arthur Clark for talking about his book, Eyes of the Tiger, and thanks to you for listening. This is D.G. Martin. I'll be back here before you know it.